Hello. Okay. Hello. Hi. Hello. Okay, so now I'm going to talk. Al, are you ready? Yeah, we're going. Woo! No. Okay, my name is Brent, and I'm an addict. Hey, Brent. Hi, guys. So Al asked me to talk a little bit about my own understanding and knowledge about addiction, so I thought I would qualify first. My name is Brent. I've been an addict, I think, my whole life, and I came to Kateri first in 1998. I know it's shocking. I look so young, but I had 10 years sobriety or recovery at one point, and then went through a divorce, and I think, like codependence, I had defined my life through relationship, and if I didn't have a relationship, I had no value. So I relapsed and went out, and it was progressively worse, as we hear it does get. And then found my way back, thank God, and I am here now. So that's a bit of my journey. Career-wise, I have been a paramedic, and now I'm a nurse. And I work in pediatrics, so I work with children from birth to adolescence, and that's sort of the lens that I try to see the world through. It's really important that I do that. So I also sometimes work in teen clinics, so we work with high-risk and marginalized teens who have addictions, trauma, codependency, sexual violence, all sorts of things. I'll try to watch my language. I see there's little ones, but it's really important for me to navigate and to understand the psychosocial growth and development and what happens at each stage of our lives and how we understand the world and how we interpret what's happening to us. And that is really going to begin the journey to healing. So as a science person, I'm proud of nursing because we really have been at the forefront of what we call evidence-based practice. So all the things I'm going to share, I do have sources. They are scientific studies. And so we used to practice in nursing theory-based medicine. So if something made sense theoretically, we would assume that it was then fact and science. So as an example, hydrogen peroxide. You have peroxisomes in your cells, and when a bacteria enters your cell, the cell releases hydrogen peroxide and kills the bacteria. So theoretically, we believed that if you had a wound on your skin and we poured hydrogen peroxide on it, that would help it keep it clean and kill all the bacteria. And that's pretty much what we believed until about 15 years ago. And then a bunch of nurses did a study where they took wounds that were identical and poured hydrogen peroxide on some of them and just poured normal saline on others. And the ones that did not receive the hydrogen peroxide actually healed faster than the ones that did. So even though in theory it makes sense that if you put hydrogen peroxide on a wound, it should heal, that's actually not science. So I think it's really important that we, when we talk about science, we're talking about things that have been tested and verified and studied. So that's sort of the lens that I come from. So it is a pretty much accepted fact that 90% of addicts have what we call complex trauma. And that's a phrase that gets bandied about all the time, and no one really talks about necessarily what it is or what it means or how we get it and then how we heal from it. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what complex trauma is and then the stages of psychosocial development and how that relates to addiction, and then we'll get to what to do about it. So what is trauma? Trauma is defined as an unexpected event or situation that is distressing or disturbing and exceeds a person's coping mechanism. So the important thing to realize there is, you know, what's traumatic to one person is not necessarily traumatic to another. Me and my brother could have a very similar experience, and if he has coping mechanisms that can manage what has happened, the event, then for him it's not traumatic, And if I have exceeded my coping mechanisms and I can't manage the event, then it is trauma for me. So that would be singular trauma or simple trauma. And when simple trauma happens, the effects of not healing from that or not recovering from that are what we call PTSD, which probably people have heard lots about, post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's all sorts of science about PTSD and how it affects us mentally, physically, emotionally. Another kind of trauma is called secondary trauma. So I'm just going to honestly share something from my story. So I was, once upon a time, a victim of sexual violence. And when I reported that to my family, they said that didn't happen. And when I wanted to talk to a physician about it, my parents said that didn't happen. And so when someone discounts or invalidates your experience of trauma, that's called secondary trauma. So that actually can be as damaging to you as the initial event, not being believed and it not being validated. And so there's a lot of people that say, you know, maybe they didn't think they had a lot of trauma in their life, or maybe they haven't had enough for it to be complex. But the reality is, if you had one simple traumatic event and then you told someone about it and they didn't believe you, that would be enough to be considered complex trauma. Complex trauma is also considered trauma on an ongoing basis. So when someone is raised in a family situation where that abuse is consistent or ongoing, that becomes traumatic. So working with children and adolescents throughout the lifespan, one of the things that we talk about a lot is attachment. So as humans, we're socialized animals, and it's very important for us to live in groups. When we're infants, Freud would say we are the id, which is the part of our psychological mind that understands the world through self only. So an infant wants to eat when it wants to eat, and it is not concerned that you are tired or that you haven't slept all day. An infant needs to be changed when it needs to be changed, and it has no understanding that it might not be convenient for the adult in its life. So what healthy attachment looks like is that when the infant cries, the parent responds to its cry. So if the infant cries, "I'm hungry," the parent feeds the child. And that develops a sense of trust and consistency. So that's a really important attachment event. When adults feed a baby, it's important that they make eye contact. And that's something that in Children's Hospital I am constantly reminding parents to do, because now that we have cell phones, parents often feed the baby with one hand and are over here playing on their phone. And the child actually needs to feel that sense of human connection when they're being fed. It's actually, we know scientifically, it is very important for their development as emotional creatures that there is actually a connection between parent and child when they're being fed. And so playing on the phone while you're doing that is actually really damaging to the child. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize that. They think feeding a baby is kind of boring, and it may be. Some people might feel that way. I don't. I love feeding babies. I work in children, so obviously children, I find them really fascinating. But so that's one really important milestone, attachment milestone. As the child becomes a toddler and starts to explore the world, that's how they're going to understand the world, through play and sensation. And they need to know that when they venture far enough away from mom or dad and when they fall down, mom or dad is going to be there to pick them up and make sure that they're okay. You know, as they start to become 3 to 7, they need to be encouraged to do independent things. Development, we call this pre-operational. So now they start to understand that words have meaning. And the really interesting thing about this is, as soon as we learn language, we learn to quantify. Things become good or bad. Good boy, bad girl, this is better than that, this is, you know, what we want. And so that instantly creates an ability where we're going to have an ability to feel inadequate, because, you know, we're going to get graded, someone's going to be better than us, and it's kind of unhealthy in the world we live in the school system we have, that there people are ranked, and that's the reality. Someone is better than you at math, but that doesn't mean they're a better person than you. The problem is that often what we do is we relate academic success to self-esteem. So I am not my grade, I am not my mark, but it's really easy when you're 5 or 7 and you're in grade 2 and you get 100 and you're told you're a good boy, and you get a 50 and you're told you're a bad boy, to think that my academic success is who I am and that my entire sense of worth is based on how adults evaluate me. The other thing that's really important at this stage, really from 3 to 11, is that there are rules in this world that children don't understand. They don't necessarily understand why you look both ways when you cross the road. They know that you have to. They don't understand about gravity and all these sorts of things. And adults are the secret keepers. They understand all these rules and all these mysteries. And so when adults do things, children assume that there's a reason, and a good reason. So when an adult tells a child, you're bad, or an adult hits us, or an adult doesn't respond to our emotional need, we assume they have a really good reason. As a child, we assume, I must be bad, I must be faulty, there must be something terribly wrong with me that my parent doesn't want to feed me or pay attention to my emotional need at this point. And that can be very simply one of the sort of births of trauma. So one of the other things that happens along the sort of psychosocial development lifespan is moral development. We learn morals and ethics and how to behave. And this is ultimately where the 12 steps come in, because, you know, as we enter recovery, everyone says, you need to grow up. You need to grow up. Well, what does that mean, and what does that look like, and why am I not grown up? So I first wanted to talk about, you know, how a healthy child sort of evolves into feel what's right and wrong in the world, and then what happens when there's trauma involved. So around age 3 to 4, Freud says, we have pain avoidance and pleasure seeking. That's our entire sense of morality. Stoves are hot and they hurt us, and that's bad. Ice cream is good and it's sweet and it makes me smile and it's good. And that is the entire morality. It's the exploratory phase. And this is where we start to use that language to judge things. Burning skin, bad. Ice cream, good. Mom smiling, good. Mom frowning, I'm bad. As we start to move through school age, they get to about 4, 5, 6, 7. And they start to realize that there's rules. So ice cream's really good, but if I go in the fridge and steal all the ice cream, and when mom hasn't said I can, and then mom gets angry, what I've learned is there's a rule there. I want the ice cream, I want to feel good, I don't want mom to be mad. Mom's anger is more important than ice cream. So that's sort of a play-by-the-rules morality that the child starts to understand. So the child seeks pain and understands, seeks pleasure and avoids pain, and understands that there's principles and rules. As they move into adolescence, they start sort of a play-by-the-rules morality. So the child, or the adolescent, wants to follow the rules just to get what they want. I'll do the right thing because it gets me more of what I want, but I don't do it for the sake of it being right or wrong, transactionally. So if we talk about lying and honesty, which is going to be big in one of the steps, an adolescent will tell you they value the truth. They value honesty because they know that's what you want to hear, and that's going to get a good result. But given the opportunity, they will tell a white lie, they will embellish, and they will avoid telling you the full truth because they know they'll get punished. So even though they can say the right words, they've learned the rules to play, that's not helpful. And so trauma at any of these phases sort of gets us stuck in those phases. So the problem about transactional morality, as I call it, would be every person you interact with becomes a means to achieving an end, which is adolescence. So if I spend time with this person, I'm cool. If I spend time with this fellow student, my teachers think I'm a nerd, or what have you. So everything becomes sort of a trade-off. And the problem with that is, as we get through life, and this is, I think, where a lot of addicts get stuck at, I know I did for a long time, is not just the manipulation piece, it's that anything worthwhile can't be traded or bargained for. You can't barter your parents to love you, you can't bargain your boss to respect you, and you can't bargain your friends to want to spend time with you. If you bargain someone into loving you, if you buy their love, they don't actually love you. If I make a transaction with you to get respect, you don't actually respect me. I can't actually do a transaction to get what I want. And that's how the codependency piece fits into this. The codependent subconsciously thinks, if I just do enough for you, I can buy your love. If I just fix you enough, you'll respect me. And they won't, and they can't, because that person that you've sought is ultimately damaged and healthy, unhealthy and broken in their own way. And I speak from personal experience. I've been in a really unhealthy, abusive relationship, and I just thought, if I could just show him that there's no amount of abuse he can dish out that'll make me stop loving him, then he'll stop hurting me. And that's just not reality. And it led me on a really dark path. And it's important for me to realize that there's nothing I could have done for him that would make him love me. There's nothing I could have done for that person that would make them stop hurting me. You know, and if I don't really value and respect myself, then how can I expect him to? Okay, So adult morality, or what we call like mature morality, or when people say you got to grow up, that's when we realize that values and principles are right and good for their own sake, even if they cause pain, and even when they don't bring us pleasure. So honesty, for instance, we accept is always right and good, even for its own sake. Because if people can't trust you, if you can't be honest, if your communication can't be relied on, there's no point in speaking to you. If I can't trust that your words are honest and true, there's no point in ever having a conversation with you. So honesty has to be a means to an end in itself. So how do children get through those phases? Through healthy adults with good boundaries and consistency. And this is where the trauma piece comes along. When I grew up, there would be times when I would do something wrong, take a cookie when I wasn't supposed to, or hit my brother with a hockey stick or a baseball bat or what have you. And sometimes there was no punishment, and sometimes the punishment was completely unproportional. You know, sometimes, you know, I would cry in a store because I wasn't getting what I wanted, and the adults would just leave me, and I was a toddler alone in a mall for several hours. And that's not an appropriate punishment. You know, sometimes I would take a cookie and get, my dad would take off his belt, and it would be extreme violence for taking a cookie. And so if you don't have consistent, reliable ability to trust that your consequences are going to be fair and right, then that is ultimately what's going to cause that that problem with understanding the rules of the work, the rules of the world and how they work. So the greatest way to learn trust is a parent who trusts you. You know, you have to trust your child a little bit, and they're going to break it, and you trust them a little bit, and they break it, and they trust them. But if your parent never trusts you, you can never learn to be trustworthy. You know, if your parent is never honest with you, you can't really learn the value of honesty. And if your parent doesn't respect you, you can't really learn respect. So what happens when there's ongoing trauma in your home, whether it's abuse, neglect, violence, however it looks for you, and sometimes it doesn't look like abuse. You know, so there was a lot of times in my family where physically I was safe, but my parents, and God bless them, I'm not speaking poorly of my parents, I love them dearly. They, like Anita said, it's intergenerational. They had their own struggles, and they did the best they could with the tools they had. It just wasn't necessarily healthy. So they were very right-wing religious, and so when I wasn't who they wanted me to be, I was evil, God hated me, I was going to go to hell, I should kill myself. That's not physical violence, but that's still traumatic. And I, at that time, didn't necessarily realize that. And I didn't necessarily understand that there's spiritual trauma there. Because we get into recovery and we need to find God, you know, according to the steps, a God of our own understanding. And I think God hates me. I think God wants me dead. I think God wants me in hell. It's going to be very, very challenging. So growing up with that sort of inconsistent, that constant abuse or trauma or neglect, however it works out, causes our nervous system to be really engaged. So we have fight, flight, or freeze. I think, did Anita talk about that a little bit? So when we're threatened by things, bioevolutionarily, we have this mechanism in our body called fight, flight, or freeze. So I see a threat to myself, and my pupils are going to get bigger, my heart rate's going to race, my breathing's going to get deeper, and the blood is going to go to my large muscles so I can run or punch or fight to escape a situation. And that's really helpful if what I'm facing is another warrior who's trying to steal my food and we're prehistoric. It's not really helpful if I'm a four-year-old and my dad is towering over me screaming at me. You know, that sort of like fight or flight doesn't really work out because I can't really fight back at that age. The next thing that happens, you have all that muscle engagement, you have all that blood running through your large muscles, is flight, run. But you can't really run away from an adult when you're four. Their legs are so much longer. And then the last thing that happens is freeze. So on a bioevolutionary sort of view of it, if a bear is running at you and you can't fight it and it's quicker than you, what your body does is just shuts down. You faint, you go unconscious, the bear thinks you're dead, and you survive. And that's sort of how detachment happens. So if you can't fight as a child, your parent, and you can't flee the situation emotionally, you're going to shut down. It's like when you're running away from that bear, except what's happening is I try to shut down my emotions. So what does this mean? This means that my entire childhood, or a large part of my childhood, my nervous system was super engaged. I was always at fight, flight, or freeze. So when I get into recovery, what happens is this is my normal. My nervous system being way up here is normal. Always being ready to fight, always being ready to run, always being ready to freeze. That's normal for me. So then I get healthy. I come into recovery. Maybe I go to treatment. Maybe I don't. Maybe I get a sponsor. Maybe I work the steps. All these things. Maybe I learn meditation. And my nervous system comes down a little bit. So I'm not like flooded with adrenaline all the time. I'm not flooded with cortisol. And I'm able to just be. And I feel so bored. Because this is my normal. So this feels boring. So a lot of addicts get into recovery, you know, who have a history of complex trauma and wonder, like, why can't I sit still? Why can't I just sit in my own skin? Why do I feel bored all the time? Why do I always wonder what's going on out there in the world? It's because your nervous system, for however old you are, 20, 15, 35 years, 25 for me, of course, has been really, really engaged in fight or flight. And so to come down to that level where everyone else is, sort of like yellow light, where, you know, if danger happens, you can respond to it, but if it doesn't, you can just enjoy the moment. We struggle with that piece. And I think that's why meditation has been so important for me, because it really helps me bring that down. Because I'm a go, go, go kind of a guy. And even in my nursing career, I went to emergency because I wanted to run all the time. I love trauma. I love blood. I love guts. I love gore. Because I'm not good at just sitting and being. You know, so that's one thing that we really need to pay attention to. The other thing that happens with complex trauma, you know, when it happens in school to adolescent age, is that we have inconsistent boundaries, and inconsistent abuse means that pain has no meaning. So when I'm a toddler and I put my hand on that hot burner, there's meaning in that pain. I've learned that burners cause me pain, and there's a reason for it, and I can avoid it, and I don't have to do it again, and there's a lesson there. If I have healthy parents that put an appropriate punishment when I lie, I learn that lying is bad, and there's a reason for my pain. When you are experiencing complex and ongoing trauma in your household as a child, there's no reason for your pain. Your pain has no meaning, and there's no point to it. So the brain, to protect us, says there's no predictability to pain. There's no solution to pain. So we enter, as Anita said, that always on guard stage, where we're always looking for that threat so we can fight, flight, or freeze. There's an interesting study they did where they took, it sounds like the most boring study to be a participant of in the world, 10,000 blue dots were going to go by the screen, and every so often one of them was going to be purple. And when you saw a purple dot, you pressed a button. And so for the first 1,000 dots, about every fifth dot was purple. And then after that, for the next 1,000 dots, they started to change the color of the purple so it got more blue. And then by the third or 4,000 dot, there was no more purple dots. People still saw a purple dot about every fifth to tenth dot. All people. So the reality, there's a special fancy name for the scientific condition, some sort of a combination. But the point here is, if I spend my first 10 years of life always looking for a threat, always looking for danger, and always seeing it, then when I get into recovery, there's no more danger necessarily. I can be safe. I can be in a room and be in my own skin and not be under any danger. But my body and my mind is obsessed with looking for that threat, and I'm always going to be looking for it. And that can be one of those challenges to coming down and to not seeing things as a threat. So this is another boring study. They wanted to see, maybe that was inaccurate. Maybe it was just color accommodation, something like that, maybe something with the eyes. So they created, they had people mark essays. And it was like a one paragraph little essay about some topic. And if it was good, they were to click one button. And if it was bad, they were to click another. So for the first like 1,000 essays they had, or 1,000 paragraphs, they had really, really good ones, like perfectly edited ones. And they had ones that were, like, there was spaces between words, everything was spelled wrong, it was like grossly wrong. And same sort of thing happened. As they transitioned to all the essays being perfect, people would still find errors or think that its perfect essays were absolutely bad, even though they were grammatically perfect. Because the reality is what we look for, what we've been trained to look for, we will see. So that's one of those things in our lives where we have to, you know, meditation is a really good trick to sort of remind ourselves that, like, there is not everything bad. I'm not always in danger. I can be calm. I can be fine. I don't have to run from everything. Right. The blue dot effect. Okay. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the science of drugs. So everyone talks about drugs damage your brain, but people don't really talk about how drugs damage your brain or what that damage looks like and can you heal from it. And I think that these are really important things to talk about. So again, I'm going with current science and I'm talking about peer-reviewed academic literature within the last 10 years, because I might say something about marijuana or cocaine and someone might disagree with it, and what I'm saying is this is the scientific world's best understanding, and if you don't agree with it, that's fine. I don't want to get into an argument with you about academic versus what you read on the internet. You believe what you choose to believe. So, as you know, we have different areas in our brain, and they all have different functions. So cocaine and crack. So we are here at Cocaine Anonymous. I thought I would start with that. One of the interesting things that our brains do is we have what is called empathic microexpressions. So if I'm talking to you and you understand what I'm saying on some level, your face muscles make miniature movements, they're called microexpressions, that mimic my microexpressions. And that tells me that you understand what I'm saying, that you are part of my group, that we are on the in and we get each other. Cocaine actually damages the part of the brain that makes those microexpressions. Why is this important? Why am I telling you this? What it means is cocaine addicts and recovering cocaine addicts are less likely to feel empathy. So if you go to your first few meetings and you don't feel connected to anyone, that's okay, that's expected. You don't mimic microexpressions from other people and you don't read other people's microexpressions. And that's fine. But knowing that helps you say, okay, so I'm going to meetings, I'm not feeling connected, I don't see anyone that would be a good sponsor because no one understands what I'm going through. That's okay, that's normal. That's part of what you've done to your brain through 5, 10, 20 years of cocaine abuse. And that's okay. And I think it's important to recognize that, because if you show up at meetings and you don't understand what you've done to your brain and or what the drugs have done to your brain and you just don't feel that connection, you think, CA is not for me, it's never going to help. It will help. You need to be patient. Your brains. So we used to think in science that brains didn't heal, because it's long and it's a really long explanation. But there's not a lot of like vessels in the brain. There's not blood in it. It's something called CSF. And anyways, what we've realized now is that they do. So if you're in a terrible car accident and they say you might never walk again, we can't actually tell you that until 2 years. It takes 2 years before we know whether or not any sort of neuronal damage to your brain is permanent. So when you come into CA, if you don't feel connected for the first 6 months and you're like, oh, man, Brent said I damaged that part of my brain, but one day it was going to get better, it still might. It just is going to take time because your brain is less vascular than the rest of your body. Things that have the most blood supply heal the quickest. Your tongue. If you ever bit your tongue and it bleeds and it bleeds and it bleeds, your tongue has a lot of vessels in it, so it heals quickly. If you've ever had a tongue ring and you take it out, it's out for like an hour and all of a sudden it's healed over and you're like, what the fuck? Ear cartilage, not very vascular. So you can have a piercing for 3 years, then you take it out for a year, then you put it back in, and it doesn't heal over. Why is that? Because cartilage is not vascular. Brains are not vascular. So they do heal, they just don't heal quickly, and that just has to be okay with you. Methamphetamine. So crystal meth, some people call it. There's lots of different names for it. I'll call it methamphetamine. The part of the brain that it damages is what we call episodic memory. So if you've ever been on vacation, if I tell you to close your eyes and remember the last time you were on a beach and you can feel the warm sun on your face and hear the sound of the waves, that's episodic memory. That's the ability to relive an event through your memory. Crystal meth damages that part of your brain. How is this important? Well, a lot of people will say, remember your bottom. Remember how you felt like the last time you had a consequence. And that can be a great tool if you are a cocaine user, an alcohol user, an opioid user. If you're a meth user, you literally cannot experience, memory-wise, the consequences of your last addiction, of your last bottom, and you are doomed to repeat it. So it's not a good tool to tell a meth head, oh, just remember what your bottom felt like. They can cognitively recall what happened at their bottom. Oh, I was living on the street, or I was in solitary, or I was assaulted in this way or that way or the other thing. But the reality is they don't feel it in the same way that people who haven't used methamphetamines might necessarily have those same things. The next drug I was going to talk about was marijuana. There's always a lot of controversy. People are like, it's legal. Okay, so is vodka. I don't drink it first thing in the morning. marijuana. So our bodies are actually, we do have nicotinic and THC receptors in our brain and all these sort of things. The important thing to remember is that it actually does slow down your reaction time. And so what they've done is they've basically given simple math tests to people, long-term smokers of marijuana, and given them a math test with different numbers, but similar, simple-wise, at day one of sobriety, day 5, day 15, what they've determined is that your processing speed is slowed down for 28 to 38 days after your last use. So if you come into recovery and think, I've been sober for a month, all the things are gone, that's actually not accurate. It takes a while for marijuana to clear from your stream. It's a fat-soluble sort of situation, and when I can go to the gym and work off water-soluble things like crystal meth or coke, and they're going to disappear from my bloodstream in 2 to 6 days, depending on lots of things, my kidneys for one. Marijuana is not that simple. It does take a while to get out of your bloodstream. And then people always want to ask me about opioids, and it's what we call neuropsychiatric effects. Here's what we know about opioids. People have been using them for so long and so medically that we haven't actually really studied. There are actually no current studies on how abuse of opioids looks as compared to non-abusive opioids. So your doctor might prescribe you OxyContin because you have no patellar, you know, joint in your knee, or you don't have like maybe spinal fusion of a couple discs, and there might be a legitimate use for you to be taking an opioid. And I have no judgment on that in recovery. If you need medication, you take the medication. It's prescribed, follow it, whatever. The reality is that we don't actually have a lot of studies to show the difference between abuse and use of opioids. We know a lot about what opioids do as far as craving, as far as your belly, as far as your sex drive. Like, there's a lot of, like, effects. But when the opioid is out of your system, most of those effects are gone. It's the withdrawal that's it's very dangerous, if not deadly, for some people. So that's what I was going to say about the science of drugs. Oh, and benzodiazepines, the same way. So the issue with benzodiazepines is it works on something in your brain called GABA, which is gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is something that your body uses to calm you down. So obviously people with an anxiety disorder, benzodiazepines can be very helpful. If you've been abusing them for a long time, what you've actually done is you've told your body that, because it mimics GABA, that you have enough GABA in your system and that you don't need to produce it. So when you try to come off a benzodiazepine addiction, what happens is that your body doesn't have any stored resources of GABA. So you will feel really anxious. And depending on the amount of the abuse and the period of time you've been doing it for, that, again, can last for up to 2 years. Ecstasy addiction, that has a similar effect. So ecstasy is 3,4-methylene dioxide methamphetamine. And what that does is it causes your brain to release an excess amount of dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine, happy chemicals. And so what happens with ecstasy and a little bit with meth is that when you take that chemical away, they've been mimicking those neurotransmitters and your body hasn't been making them. So there's a 6-month period, approximately, for most recovering addicts from methamphetamines, ecstasy or crystal, where it's called anhedonia. It's an inability to feel pleasure. And that sounds terrible, and it is. And that's one of the reasons people relapse. So the thing that I would suggest as a medical professional is see your doctor. There are medications like venlafaxine or some SSRIs that can really help with the depression, but I think it's helpful to have the knowledge to know if you're in early recovery and you are feeling crazy and like nothing feels good, that might be true. Maybe nothing feels good. Maybe that is, in fact, what's happened with your brain, and it's just going to take time and patience. And as we know, as addicts, we're not really good with delayed gratification and thinking that at some point we're going to heal. It's persistence and it's patience, and that's really important. The other thing I like to talk about is that people often talk, okay, so you've talked about trauma and you've talked about like how parenting affected us and 90% of addicts, and we became addicts and experienced complex trauma. So what can I do differently? I have kids. I want to be a good parent. And it sounds a little crazy because I'm not a parent, so how can I tell you how to parent? But I'm also not a woman, and I did work in maternity, and I taught women how to breastfeed. So I have the knowledge. I don't necessarily have the experience, and that doesn't mean I don't have good things to say. The simplest way that I break it down when I talk to parents, so as a nurse in children's hospital, I see a lot of judgments in the world. So there are parents that maybe don't have skills when it comes to something as simple as swaddling a baby, changing a diaper, feeding, and that's okay. And some nurses leave those patients' rooms and go, oh, I hate that family. They don't know how to change their baby. And I think, ugh, so frustrating. And I'll be like, I love that family because they love their kid. They're so excited. They're in there. Both parents are here. Like, for a week that that kid's been in the hospital, I think that's amazing. And there are kids that, you know, maybe come from wealthier or higher socioeconomic backgrounds whose parents have a lot of knowledge, but mom's busy on her phone making manicure appointments and dad hasn't ever visited once in the 2 months the kid's been there for whatever he's there for. So I think love is really, like, what I like to see in my patients and their families. And so I try to point that out to my coworkers when they make judgments about people's parenting ability. And what I say to the parents is, you know, as your child learns to speak 100 times a day in 100 different ways, not directly, that kid's going to ask you, do I value? Do I matter? Am I important? And am I loved? And how you respond, that is going to dictate your kid's behavior. So I have a lot of parents that come in and their kid has what they call ODD. It's sort of like the latest diagnosis, oppositional defiance disorder. And it means that you ask your kid to do something, he says no. I just call that toddlerhood. I work in a hospital. I want to take your blood pressure. No. All right. Well, I'm bigger than you. I win. but, you know, a lot of parents are like, I don't know what to do. Like, my kid is always upset. He always says no. He doesn't do what I want him to do. And I say, you know, there's a lot of time that he's spending telling you what his needs are. Maybe not verbally. Maybe not saying, I'm lonely and I need a hug. But that how you react to and respond to what he's asking from you is going to be a very clear response of what you can do for him. And I just wanted to share this one cute little story when it comes to trauma and healing from trauma. I had a 5-year-old. I'm going to, like, erase all the details, so I'm not breaking any rules. But he came in, and it was told to us that he was extremely delayed and nonverbal. He was still in diapers. And I thought, well, that's really sad, but some people are just born and they have some brain conditions and they're just not going to develop in the same cognitive way the rest of us do. And he was with us for a couple months because he was getting lots of surgery done. So I saw this kid all the time. So it was probably, you know, week 2, I'm showing some nursing students some proper ways to wash your hands because hand washing is everything for us. If you don't know what to do, wash your hands. That's my rule in the hospital. And so I start talking about hand washing with these nursing students, and this little 5-year-old behind me goes, and he's like washing his wrists, and he's washing the tips of his fingers, and he's washing his thumb. He's washing his hands like a surgeon does. And I was like, he's not delayed. No one's interacted with him. And it's true, like, his parent was there and was never, ever paying attention to him. And I was like, okay, well, is what it is. And then one day I'm in the, like, Pyxis room preparing that's where we make drugs. So I'm, like, you know, getting my drugs out. And it's a locked room with, like, a secret code. And I hear the door swing open, and sometimes it's another nurse. And I'll be like, oh, can you sign this whatever for me? And so I was like, oh, hey. And then I turn around, and it's this kid. And I was like, how did you get in here? And he, like, points to the door, and he, like, points out the code. And I was like, wow. And the reality is that he's now doing quite well. You know, so he had a really traumatic beginning of life. He didn't have a bed. He lived in a house with probably 18 other people. He slept on a pile of dirty laundry. No one ever spoke to him. The only time he would get changed is if he threw a clean diaper at one of the adults who were walking by, and they would change him. And he had no language when I met him. And, you know, now he does have language, and he's just a smart whippersnapper. So just to not get that sort of point of view that we can't heal and we can't change, or that it's too late, or that trauma's already happened. You know, I know that there are some parents that I've talked to or have talked to me after meetings and said, you know, I was, you know, in the problem for the first few years of my child's life. Is, you know, can I fix it? Absolutely, you can fix it. You know, the one thing I really love about children is they are really, really resilient, surprisingly resilient. So, that would be the message I would like to leave us with, is just that our bodies have this incredible ability to change and heal if we are patient, you know? And when we look at where do the steps come in? So if we have that sort of transactional morality when we're only honest when it's going to get us something, you know, step 9 is really going to take us a super far way, because we're going to understand that we need to be honest all the time. Not because it's going to get us things, and sometimes it's really hard. I've made my amends. I'm in the process, Shay knows, of making my amends right now, and sometimes it really sucks. Like, looking up your ex-spouse and telling them all, not just necessarily like making them feel shitty about it, but telling them you acknowledge how much I harmed them, and saying, you know, your ability to be present and to show up for me and to guide me back to recovery and to be patient and tolerant when I was being insane taught me a lot of things, and I'm grateful for your presence in my life, and I'm a better person because of, you know, who you've been in my life, and I'm really sorry for how much space my addiction took up in yours. That's a hard message to give to someone who you were with for a long time, but that's honesty, you know? And now I can walk around, and if I happen to see my spouse at the university or whatever, it's like, I can wave. I don't have to. I would like to, but that's a whole other story. But I don't have to feel guilty about carrying all that stuff with me, you know? And ultimately getting to step 12, where we're all about helping someone else. That is ultimately emotional maturity. You know, Al asked me, oh, can you come teach a meditation? The selfish me wants to say no. The id in me, that three-year-old boy that just wants to eat cookies and forget that the rest of the world exists because I'm in pain, that man wants to say no. I'm going to stay home, and I'm sleeping in and cuddling my dog and watching Netflix and chain-smoking. But thank you for this program and to the people in this program and steps and my sponsor and the lessons I've learned through meditation. I show up. Al asks me to teach a meditation. I come teach a meditation. Al's like, I need you to fill in an hour on addiction, something science-y about drugs. Okay, I can talk about the science of drugs. If I had a whiteboard, oh my God, you guys would be in for a real treat. It's probably a reason why Al didn't get me a whiteboard. Anyways, so that would be some ramblings about growth, development, complex trauma, and morality from me. Thanks. And now Jolene is going to come sing a song for us.